The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter and probably from the Harvard Health Letter as well. And the first thing I'm going to do is to continue an article about vertigo from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter of April 2021, which I began on the previous episode. The next section is entitled, When Dizziness Doesn't Stop. Many of the conditions that were talked about before lead to dizziness or vertigo that goes away naturally after a period of time. But what if you've been experiencing dizziness that waxes and wanes almost daily for months? If that's the case, you may have persistent postural perceptual dizziness, or PPPD. That's quite a mouthful. This condition has only recently been defined, though there were several similar conditions like chronic subjective dizziness. People with PPPD can be frustrated by a lack of diagnosis, especially as many typical diagnostic tests come back normal with this condition. PPPD is defined as experiencing dizziness or unsteadiness most days for 3 months or more. Spinning vertigo is not a symptom of PPPD, but you may simultaneously have a separate condition that causes vertigo. PPPD can start after an ailment, whether episodic, acute, or chronic, that causes vertigo, dizziness, unsteadiness, or balance problems. These ailments include vestibular migraine, whiplash, BPPV, Meniere's disease, and anxiety-related dizziness. The exact cause of PPPD is not known, but it's thought that your body doesn't adapt properly after these experiences. Normally, to compensate for dizziness, vertigo, or balance problems, you may automatically depend more on visual cues and less on information from your sensory nerves and inner ear. You may move stiffly and carefully, or take smaller steps in order to keep your balance. Many people use these adaptations for a short time and intuitively stop using them as their dizziness or vertigo fades. But for some people, these adaptations may last too long, possibly due in part to increased anxiety. The result is the body becomes too sensitive to its own movement and balance. It's unknown how common PPPD is, but similar symptoms affect 25% of people who previously experienced some sort of short-term or episodic vestibular problem. PPPD symptoms wax and wane and can be worsened by standing or walking and by visually demanding or busy environments like supermarkets, highly patterned carpets, and computer work. Your symptoms may get so bad that you avoid certain environments or activities. However, treatments are available for PPPD. Although more research is needed, you may consider medication, like selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs, and selective serotonin and norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, SNRIs, which both have appeared to be helpful in alleviating dizziness. Vestibular rehabilitation. in this physical therapy, you will perform exercises and gradually be exposed to things that seem to make your dizziness worse. The idea is that repeated exposures will help you tolerate and adapt to them. Cognitive behavioral therapy. It appears that this type of talk therapy may be helpful for those with PPPD, especially for those who have anxiety with their dizziness. A comprehensive treatment plan may include all the above and is likely to produce an over 50% decrease in symptoms in 8 to 12 weeks. If your PPPD is related to other conditions like migraine or anxiety, that condition should also be treated. You can help facilitate your recovery by slowly following your treatment plan and by keeping up your daily activities as much as possible. The article goes on to describe health tips. And it says, ask away. Facing a major procedure or surgery, or even just a checkup, may make you feel anxious or confused. Use these tips to more confidently approach a medical appointment and to help your care team better meet your needs. First, plan ahead. Pause to think about what you want to get from the appointment. What are your goals? Write down and prioritize questions. Bring your list to the appointment and refer to it. Next, engage in discussion and take notes. You can ask questions like, how will I receive results from this test? Why do you think that's the problem? Would you consider this treatment as the best of my options? Are there other options I should consider? For clarification, summarize what you heard and then ask, am I understanding that right? Voice your concerns. If you're worried about anything, like a potential side effect or your ability to follow through with the treatment plan, voice them so they can be addressed. You can ask for a follow-up appointment to talk further or seek a second opinion from another doctor. Also, call for backup. Consider bringing a trusted friend or family member with you. Let them know if and when you want them to speak up. Take notes or leave the room during the appointment. Follow up. Ask, what's the best way to get more information or ask questions after my visit? That way, if you're later confused or need more information, you can get answers. Asking questions and raising concerns with your care team sets you up for success and enables your team to better take care of you. The next article from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter is called Ultrasounds Rapid Advancement, Diagnosis, Therapy, and More. A boy or a girl. Many people are most familiar with ultrasound imaging for the answer it can provide to this question for expectant parents and interested grandparents. And while you may think of ultrasound as an older technology with limited use, the exact opposite is true. Using ultrasound for diagnostics and therapy is on the cutting edge of technologic advancement. And uses for ultrasound are constantly being improved and are expanding into new areas. That's important because ultrasound technology has several positive features. There's no radiation involved, and low-energy ultrasound used for diagnostic imaging causes no harm to body tissues or to metal implants. Devices are becoming increasingly portable, yet also more sophisticated. Ultrasound is generally a low-cost technology with increasing capability. Ultrasound is non-invasive, meaning there's no need to cut or puncture tissue. And it uniquely characterizes tissues in ways that other imaging scans can't. At a basic level, ultrasound devices consist of a transducer, often handheld, that emits high-frequency sound waves. In the case of diagnostic imaging, the surface of the transducer is placed near the area being imaged. Emitted sound waves bounce off various tissues, like bone or muscle, at different rates and return to the transducer. The ultrasound device calculates variations in bounce rates to produce an image on the screen. Ultrasound can also be used for therapy, in which high-intensity focused ultrasound focuses sound waves on a desired location, where they can modify tissues by heating or even destroying the tissues. To learn more about advances and the future of ultrasound, we talked to Dr. Scott Young, MD, a radiologist and ultrasound expert at the Mayo Clinic in Scottsdale, Arizona. The first question was, how has ultrasound changed over the years? The biggest change has been the greatly reduced size of ultrasound visualization equipment. This has allowed ultrasound use to expand from the radiology department to throughout the hospital and into clinics and outpatient areas. You may see ultrasound performed using a tablet or a smartphone-sized device. You may have an appointment in which a portable ultrasound is used to view a small joint or to give an injection. With pain management, portable ultrasound may be used to visualize injection of a pain drug around a nerve. In addition, the cost of some ultrasound equipment has come down considerably, bringing it into wider use. The transducers have undergone a slower evolution in terms of how they look. However, the ability of those transducers to penetrate tissue deeper and create higher resolution images has gradually improved. In addition, there are 3D transducers. They don't look all that different, but they emit and receive ultrasound in a way that allows a 3D image to be digitally assembled by a computer and displayed, sometimes in motion, which is called 4D. In what ways have ultrasound diagnostic capabilities expanded beyond the familiar tests, like visualizing the fetus in pregnancy or visualizing the heart or abdominal organs? There are so many areas of advancement, I'll just highlight a few. One is that higher resolution transducers allow us to use ultrasound to guide placement of biopsy needles into smaller and smaller areas, like a small, suspicious spot in the liver. There's also the ever-increasing ability to visualize small nerves and tendons, increasing the ability to make very detailed diagnoses of these small structures. Like with carpal tunnel issues. Add to that the ability to visualize these areas while joints or tendons are moving. Another important area is very detailed imaging of the bowel and other abdominal organs for diagnosing and monitoring Crohn's disease and endometriosis. For example, you can look to see if there are adhesions behind the uterus that would indicate endometriosis. This is not something that's easily done with other types of imaging. Doppler elastography, that's ELASTOGRAPHY, is another new area. This is the ability to send pulse waves into tissue and then look at how the tissue reacts to those waves. This provides a result called shear wave, which gives a measurement of the stiffness of tissue. Right now, this technology is mainly used to identify and map the stages of stiffening of liver tissue, which includes scarring, fibrosis, and eventually cirrhosis, potentially avoiding the need for biopsy. Another exciting area involves using microbubbles of gas as a contrast agent. The microbubbles, which have no effect on kidneys or any other organs, can be used in anyone, unlike contrast tests and other imaging tests, and travel through the bloodstream and can be seen with ultrasound imaging. When the microbubbles flow into the blood vessels of a tumor, they provide the ability to look at the vascular structures of the tumor in order to make a diagnosis, to indicate characteristics of the tumor, or to help guide a biopsy of the tumor. Question. Unlike other imaging devices, ultrasound has a dual role as a device that can deliver therapy. How is this done? Ultrasound directly delivers therapy by heating tissue. But I want to make a clear distinction between high-frequency, low-energy ultrasound we use for diagnosis, which causes almost no tissue heating or interaction, and the high-intensity focused ultrasound, HIFU, that's used to heat tissues. With HIFU, you can focus on a specific area, causing tissue heating, and if desired, tissue destruction. This capability has been around for a while, but a newer use of HIFU is to heat up and kill tumor cells that are found in the prostate. Also on the near horizon is the use of ultrasound to facilitate targeted drug therapy, like delivering chemotherapy to a tumor. Similar to the way the microbubbles are used for diagnosis, there is the potential to encase therapeutic drug molecules in microbubbles, and then ultrasound would basically pop those bubbles within target tissue. For a tumor, you'd watch those microbubbles flow into the blood vessels of the tumor with low-energy ultrasound, then turn on a high-energy ultrasound to pop the bubbles, only when inside the tumor, delivering the drug molecules specifically to the tumor. There's a subheading that's entitled Lifestyle Changes to Live Healthier and Longer. And again, this comes from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter from April. Thanks to advances in medicine, science, and public health, life expectancy has climbed to impressive heights. From 1900 to 2000, life expectancy in the United States jumped from 47.3 years to 76.8 years and has since increased to 78.6 years in 2017, or in other words, 76.1 years for men and 81.1 years for women. That's great news, but how many of those years are spent in good health? As we age, we want to stay healthy, active, and independent. This concept is sometimes referred to as your health span, which has been defined as the period of life spent in good health, free from chronic disease and the disabilities of aging, as opposed to your lifespan or how long you live. The steps to increase your likelihood of disease-free living are just what you'd expect, healthy lifestyle choices. There was a recent study published in the British Medical Journal. The study set out to see how five factors, not smoking, maintaining a healthy body mass index, performing regular, moderate, or vigorous physical activity, drinking alcohol only in moderation, and eating a healthy diet, affected the number of years you'd be expected to live without developing type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, or cancer. Expected years of life without these diseases rose with each healthy lifestyle factor engaged in, as seen in the table that was attached. Among participants without type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and cancer at age 50, women with four or five elements of a healthy lifestyle were expected to live 11 years longer without developing those diseases than were those with none. For men, the difference was 7.6 years. Even if you've been diagnosed with a chronic disease, these diseases can often be kept under control with a combination of personal effort and help from your healthcare team. It's also not too late to start practicing a healthy lifestyle. The study found that people who implemented four or five factors had longer survival after being diagnosed with chronic conditions than did people who didn't implement any of them. For example, women who are disease-free at age 50 but have no healthy lifestyle factors can be expected to develop type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, or cancer at age 73.7. Women who have four or five healthy lifestyle factors can be expected to develop diabetes, cardiovascular disease, or cancer at age 84, which is approximately 11-year difference. Now I'm going to turn to a different section of the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, which is called Second Opinion. Question: should I get the COVID-19 vaccine even if I've already had COVID-19? I thought that having the virus gave me immunity. Answer: the protection a person gets from having an infection varies depending on the disease and from person to person. It's true that having COVID-19 offers some immunity from reinfection with the virus, but because the COVID-19 virus is still new and thus not fully understood, it's not clear how long that protection lasts. Current evidence suggests that reinfection with the COVID-19 virus is uncommon in the first 90 days after an initial infection. Because reinfection is possible, and COVID-19 can cause severe medical complications and even death, it's recommended that people who have already had COVID-19 get a COVID-19 vaccine. According to the Centers for Disease Control, the vaccination should be offered to you regardless of whether you've already had an infection, and you're not required to have an antibody test before being vaccinated. However, if you are currently infected with the virus, you should wait to get vaccinated until after your illness has resolved and you've met the criteria to discontinue isolation. It would also be reasonable to wait until the end of a 90-day period after the onset of COVID-19 symptoms, the minimum current time frame of expected natural immunity, to be vaccinated. If you receive treatment with a monoclonal antibody or convalescent plasma because of your infection, the CDC recommends waiting 90 days after that treatment to be vaccinated to avoid any interference of the antibody treatment with the immune response provided by the vaccination. With vaccine distribution, first priority is given to healthcare workers, adult residents of long-term care facilities, adults 75 and older, and frontline essential workers. It has then been prioritized for adults 65 to 74, as well as adults under 65 who are at high risk of complications of COVID-19 due to underlying health conditions. Question: I tend to feel cold, but my husband is always comfortable or even warm. It seems many women are often colder than men. What's the difference? To explain why you may feel colder than your husband, it's helpful to understand how your body adapts to cold. Your body tries to maintain its core temperature by limiting the heat leaving your body. It can do this by narrowing blood vessels and decreasing blood flow to the surface of your body, which keeps heat near the core. This is why you can suddenly find yourself with a cold nose, hands, and feet. But if that's not sufficient, your body must generate heat. Your sympathetic nervous system can turn up your cellular metabolic rate, and your body can start shivering, as these involuntary muscle contractions also produce heat. Men and women may experience these processes differently, probably because of general differences in body composition and proportions. For example, one small experiment exposed young men and women to cold and found that women began shivering at 52 degrees Fahrenheit, whereas men did not start until 49 degrees. Compared with men of the same weight, women have less muscle mass. Women also generally have a higher body surface area to mass ratio. More surface area makes it more difficult to retain heat, since heat can be lost through the skin, and a lower muscle mass limits how much heat you can generate when you are exposed to cold temperatures. The solution to feeling chilly is often as simple as wearing extra layers of clothing, turning up the thermostat, or engaging in physical activity. But it's sometimes the case that medical conditions like underactive thyroid, Raynaud's disease, or severe anemia can cause you to feel colder than usual. However, these conditions have other symptoms in addition to increased cold sensitivity. Consult with your healthcare provider if you seem to feel abnormally cold compared with others, especially if you're also experiencing fatigue, weakness, or other notable changes to your body or your overall health. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. I enjoyed it and I hope you did too.